Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. This week I'm exploring the world of artificial intelligence, asking how it will shape our lives and what we should do now to prepare for its impact.
Today we launch an intelligent synthetic life form, a full-size serving man. Our serving man has a small computer in his cranium.
The unveiling of an artificially intelligent robot in the story Super Toys Last All Summer Long by the science fiction writer Brian Aldiss, who died this week. Now, that future is here, and it's set to alter the way we live.
I can't think of an advance in human history that will have such an impact as artificial intelligence since, for example, the invention of the printing press.
Some people are pretty worried about AI in the longer term.
I believe that the rise of powerful AI will be either the best thing or the worst ever to happen to humanity.
Eminent authorities such as the physicist Stephen Hawking and Tesla's Elon Musk are concerned that highly intelligent machines will eventually come into conflict with human beings. But eventually is still a way away, and AI is now all around us in our everyday lives. Things are happening fast. Step inside the briefing room to find out what AI actually is, how it will shape our world, and how we should prepare for those changes now. First of all, what actually is artificial intelligence? I invited David Baker into the briefing room to explain. He's a contributing editor at the technology magazine Wired.
AI, or artificial intelligence, is our attempt to make computers think in the same way that we humans think. We're used to computers processing numbers in a kind of rigid way. We feed a load of numbers into a computer and ask it to make the total, and out pops the sum of those numbers. But we humans don't think in that way at all. We actually are pretty bad at adding together a load of numbers or processing numbers in a rigid way. We tend to take clues from all around us and use our what we call our intuition to make decisions. And AI is an attempt to enable computers to use that similar instinct to make decisions by intuition, if you like, and therefore understand the world better.
We are the robots. We are the robots.
When we think of artificial intelligence, we tend to think of some astonishing robot mind that's a bit like an amazing human mind that can do anything. We're not quite there yet. AI tends to be quite specific in what it can do. AI is all around us. We're interacting with it almost continually, especially in the developed world, especially in the world where we rely a lot on technology. I took a lift up to this studio, and that was controlled by AI. When we buy airline tickets, the pricing is controlled by AI. The way traffic runs through cities is controlled by AI. Dating sites, medical diagnoses, face recognition when you go through passport at security, whether or not you get a credit card when you make an application for it, all of this is AI in action. It's going to have a big impact on the way we relate to the world of work. Obviously, it's a good idea to get computers and robots to do drudgery work. But what if it starts taking on the interesting work? What will we then do after that? Some people say there's some areas of human activity which AI could never go into, and that includes things like empathy or creativity. But in fact, it may turn out that these are just engineering problems. And in fact, there are plenty of AI applications around the world which are producing music, producing prose, producing paintings, which are pretty good. And this is probably just the start. A really big moment in the history of AI came last March when a computer program called AlphaGo beat the world's best human player at the board game Go.
Of course, we're very, very excited about this historic moment. And, you know, we're very pleased with how AlphaGo performed.
This is a landmark because for the first time we'd created intelligence that is way better than any human intelligence on Earth. And this is a very significant breakthrough because it means that artificial intelligence has probably gone on to the next level. Some people have become scared by this breakthrough. The idea that if we're going to create, for want of a better word, a mind which thinks more quickly, more capably, more adeptly than we humans think, then will that mind somehow get carried away and keep on growing and keep on becoming more powerful and in the end, I guess, take over the world? Me, I'm not sure which way it'll go. I'm not one of these people who say we need to stop the rise of the robots now because they're just going to eat us all up for dinner. But I'm also aware that sometimes science goes in directions we're not really sure. I think we simply cannot know where it's going to go. But a very big area that we need to invest in is often called AI ethics, which sounds funny. It's asking robots to follow ethics. But really, that's not it. It's asking us to set down the ethics of the way we'll use the robot. A very big area where ethics is important is the fact that for a lot of AI, we don't actually know how it makes its decisions. We should do as much research as we possibly can into working out how these decisions are made, how we can, if you like, regulate or manage those decisions. And right now, the fact that we don't quite know how it makes these decisions, and we're applying that vagueness to important human behaviours, is something that should alarm us. That's the area of AI ethics that I think we should be looking into.
David Baker. So, far from sounding like this...
Hasta la vista, baby.
The Terminator, of course. In reality, AI sounds a bit more prosaic.
Alexa, tell Hive to turn the heating on.
All right. What temperature would you like?
Mundane, maybe. But if David Baker is right about ethics, then the question of AI is fraught. Put simply, what questions do we need answers to right now to prepare ourselves for the seismic changes AI will bring? Now, this is such a massive subject that I want to focus on a few important areas that have a tangible impact on our day-to-day lives. First, I want to understand how businesses will use AI, are using it. Cathy O'Neill is a former quantitative finance and data scientist for Wall Street, meaning her job was to analyse data. She recently wrote a book called Weapons of Math Destruction and has concerns about how companies use mathematical algorithms or AI to sell us their products or ideas. She was in New York, but in voice, she visited the briefing room earlier.
So I'm not worried about the far future of AI because I actually think we have plenty to worry about right now. AI is being constantly used right now by powerful corporations mostly, or sometimes powerful government agencies, to make decisions about people that have less power. These systems are not flawless. They have deep flaws, and we need to interrogate them.
Can you take us through what you think some of the flaws are?
There was a man that I interviewed whose son, Kyle Beam, failed a personality test to get a minimum wage job in Atlanta, Georgia. It turns out that 70% of job seekers in the U.S., and I think 57% in the U.K., in order to get a job, have to go through an online personality test. The personality tests are developed using AI, and yet they're not necessarily 100% accurate, or for that matter, legal. This young man, Kyle Beam, he failed his personality test, and he has a very strong suspicion that it's because he has bipolar disorder. And a series of questions reminded him of the mental health assessment he would be asked to take in the hospital when he was being treated. His father, who's a lawyer, said that this is illegal under the Americans with Disability Act, but the regulators aren't on top of this because they don't know how to parse or understand or audit an algorithm of that type. These companies that are using algorithms to filter out applicants for jobs, they don't understand the algorithms. The people that build the algorithms don't necessarily understand them. The people that actually take the tests certainly don't understand them. And yet they might not be accurate nor even legal.
Now, presumably, that's just one example trying to get a job. AI algorithms, I think they're essentially the same thing, really, aren't they?
Absolutely.
They apply in all kinds of circumstances in which you might be judged for something, like getting a credit card.
Getting a credit card, insurance companies use them, absolutely, to reduce their risk. But I'll say that, you know, speaking as a former data scientist working in this field of profiling users online, we are understanding people through their demographics and their marketing silos, not through their actual behavior, which means that we can infer anything we want from, for example, their zip code. In the States, that means mostly it means race, it means class, and we are really making deep connections between these correlations between class and race and what we think the future of these people should look like.
Now, how far are these algorithms based on what you might call historic behavior? In other words, they kind of replicate what's already happened. That's their model.
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. All AI, every single algorithm out there, is trained on historical data. And moreover, it's not trained to ask questions like why. Why are women not succeeding in this company, for example? It doesn't ask why didn't women succeed. It never wants to know that. It just notes that women weren't successful in this company. And then it propagates that. When you apply such an algorithm to an application pool, it'll see women and men, maybe equally qualified women and men, but it'll remember that pattern that, oh, women didn't succeed in this culture in the past, therefore, let's not hire any women. That's just an example. But the point is that these machine learning algorithms are in some sense incredibly naive, right? You're just training them on what historical data you have. But that historical data is a reflection, an echo, if you will, of your own culture. And if your culture is imperfect, as most culture is, then the machine learning algorithm will propagate that imperfect culture.
What could you do about it? Could you program it to behave in a different way?
Absolutely. What I'm calling for is a monitor of how it's behaving already, right? So it's almost impossible to expect an algorithm given biased data to come out with an unbiased output. But you can monitor the output. You can sort of by hand redo the old-fashioned sociological experiment where you would see 100 applications to a job where 50 of them were men and 50 of them were women, all equally qualified. And you would see how many of the women made it through, how many of the men made it through.
Now, that means systematic review of the results, of algorithmic results.
Yes.
Somebody's got to do that. Somebody's got to decide to do that. I mean, and given that's going to be, forgive my French, a pain in the ass for a lot of companies, how are we going to get them to do that?
It's a really good question. I even set up an algorithmic auditing company a year ago, and I've only gotten one client so far, which shows you how much motivation there is for these companies to look into their algorithms and see if they're working well. Not much. I think the way we're going to do it is through pressure, through leverage. And that could either come through the form of regulation, that algorithms have to be provably fair, provably legal, which I think absolutely should happen. Many of the laws are already there. They're just not being applied to algorithms, like the one I told you about with personality tests. And then the other way that we could get leverage is through lawsuits.
Kathy O'Neill. To discuss businesses' use of AI, Pippa Malgren has joined me in the briefing room. Pippa was an economic advisor to President George W. Bush and is the founder of H Robotics, so it's safe to say she's embracing the AI revolution. Welcome, Pippa. What are businesses using AI for?
Well, I think the most important thing is always innovation. It's the creation of new things. It's the whole act of creativity and design and build, as opposed to moving something that exists, monitoring something that exists. Those things can be done by artificial intelligence by itself. But creating new things, that's where human beings are required with the assistance of artificial intelligence.
So do you think, for instance, that we will have AI fashion designers?
Absolutely. We will have AI-assisted fashion design because that's already with us now. The materials, the fabrics that we create will absolutely be assisted by artificial intelligence. systems. This is already in play. There's a something called Project Jacquard that Google has done in conjunction with Levi's, where they're converting your Levi's basically into the telephone interface. So you won't need your screen. You'll just tap on your jeans and then you will be connected to the net. I mean, that's already real now.
Sorry, Pippa, take me through that. Did I misunderstand that? I tap on my jeans and I'm connected to the internet.
That you have not misunderstood. It's about making fabrics, the interface, and frankly, even your skin. At MIT, they developed biometric tattoos, that's a temporary tattoo you can put on your skin that becomes a keypad that you can operate your internet and your phone off of. You don't need the screen on your phone any longer. So that's why I say all this is already real. It's in prototype, but, you know, it's working.
Pippa, I have enough problems with making pocket calls as it is. I mean, can you imagine doing that because you brushed against the wrong person on
the
tube? I
hear you. We're all going to have to get more savvy about all this stuff.
Yeah, well, exactly. So that brings me on to the next point. We've been listening to Cathy O'Neill talk about some of the problems and concerns about actually how AI can be used. Do you share these worries about the difficulty in understanding why AI has taken the decision it has, the difficulties in discovering what its intentions are, the problems of biases and so on? Do you share these worries?
Well, look, it's always the good and the bad, the upside and the downside. I feel very strongly that we're entering in a world where we're going to be saying the algorithm made me do it, right? I didn't have a choice. The algorithm showed me the news it wanted to show me, and I didn't get to see the news that actually I might have enjoyed or wanted to see otherwise. It's a world where the algorithm is definitely going to make choices on your behalf that you may not be aware of. So some of those choices may be good ones. Some of those may not be good ones. But the key thing is to understand what is the space we're operating in. I, on the one hand, really look forward to a world where I put a small device in my ear and now I can speak to anyone in any language without any delay. And so now I can converse literally with the entire world. That's a wonderful application of AI. I'm not looking forward to a world where we have automated weapon systems that are driven by artificial intelligence, not subject to overrides. So again, as David Baker mentioned, we've got lots of ethical issues. And I think that the new form of democracy we're going to have is definitely going to be determined by all these systems and processes.
Now, you talked about the person who gets news from one source and not from another, not based on an actual choice they've made, but based on a series of historic choices they might have made. Somebody's making that judgment for them. Do you think that the individual needs to know how that choice was made?
I think it's yes, and it's going to become far more complex. I'll give you one small example. We're entering a world where everyone's talking about blockchain. Nobody knows really what it is. Simply put, it's a accounting ledger in the cloud, and it captures not just every transaction that you are engaged in. It will also start to capture every action and every reaction, as an emotional reaction. So when you go to the movies, there'll be cameras around the cinema screen that will capture your emotional reaction. It will triangulate and connect that with your payments history, and it will triangulate and connect that with your physical movements in the city. So, for example, China is pioneering a social credit system where basically an individual gets an Uber score. Now, I find this a little worrying for the future of democracy because it can figure out you borrowed your mom's car, she's got a disabled parking permit, you pull into that bay even though she's not with you. It will clock that you've done it, and suddenly your mortgage rate goes up and your eligibility for government jobs goes down. So yes, we want to know on what basis is the system making decisions. That's some to do with artificial intelligence. That's some to do with government and its systems and how it will use this. It's some to do with companies and how that data goes up into that clocked environment that keeps track of who you are and what you're doing.
Now, this sounds to me like we need a complete change of attitude towards regulation in this. In other words, we need to try and get ahead of the game. What do we need to do?
Well, it's not so simple. As a small example, you know, companies that make tin cans that we drink a Coca-Cola or something out of, increasingly being offered the kinds of chips that you can place in the bottom that capture the genetic data of the person drinking from the can.
You're kidding.
I'm totally not kidding. And so so far, most companies are saying, no, we don't want that. But there's unbelievable value in such information. So at some point, that's going to happen. This is the type of thing one wants to be made aware of and alert to.
In your experience, I mean, you've worked with government, Pippa. Do politicians understand this new world?
I think it's so fast moving that the only people who really understand it are the scientists involved at the sort of coalface cutting edge of the field. And most of them, apologies in advance to scientists everywhere, but they do tend to not be terribly articulate about what they're doing because they're so caught up in the complexity of the detail. So I think there's an immense opportunity and demand for people who can interface between the scientists and the society. And that, but politicians usually are behind on these sorts of things. So help them catch up. We have an opportunity here to try to get in front of it instead of shy away from it.
Yeah, but how are we going to do that, given the problem that you've just pointed out, which is that the people who have to make those decisions are not very well able to do that? You seem to be suggesting that what we need to do is create almost a kind of new profession of explainers.
Yes. The narrative, the storytellers, and the explainers. And we are more empowered than ever to be able to do this. The issue is not that we can't do it. The issue is our attitude. And I think that especially older people, of which I am one, there's a general attitude that this is all too hard. This is for young people. I can't keep up. I think that's nonsense. We are all obliged as citizens to get with the program and start to get on this learning curve and use the technology. I mean, we have more power in our iPhones today than they used to have in a defense lab in the 1960s. We sent men to the moon on less power than an iPhone has in your pocket. I mean, can you imagine today if you said, I'm going to use my iPhone to send a guy to the moon, right? You'd be arrested. But the amount of power you have gives you the ability to navigate in this environment. But if we don't take advantage of it, we will only have ourselves to blame.
Pippa Malgren. To me, easily one of the most significant areas for AI development mentioned by David Baker is healthcare. It's a very good example of opportunities and dilemmas. To learn more about how AI will affect it, I've invited Regina Barzilai into the briefing room. Regina is Professor of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Regina, could you explain your particular interest in this area?
The way I got into this field was highly personal. In 2014, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I was 43 at the time, and it came as a huge, huge surprise. But what was more surprising is how the treatment was done. I was treated in one of the best hospitals in the U.S., Massachusetts General Hospital, MGH. Even though my treatment was excellent, I was really surprised to see how little machine learning and AI is actually done. You know, more I learn about oncology and all the different areas, there is a lot of uncertainty. Most of the oncology today is driven by clinical trials. In the United States, American Society of Clinical Oncology explicitly states that all the clinical decisions are based on 3% of the population that participate in clinical trials. 97% of the data is currently not used to make decisions. So clearly, the treatments cannot be personalize properly.
So essentially, what you're saying is if we were able to look at the data from the full patient set, not just the clinical trials, we would get a much, much, much sharper diagnostic capacity and ability to target both diagnosis and treatment.
Absolutely. Right now, if you are thinking about the treatment, the doctor takes, let's say, a mammogram, they read it up manually, extract some features. If the patient seems to have cancer, they do pathology again, extract some features. There is a lot of information buried in images, buried in the pathology slides. We throw out a lot of this information because humans really cannot process it and use some very, very high-level abstraction of the patients, and then we're trying to match this patient with cure. And all our ability to personalize and to see all those subtleties which distinguish a patient for whom the treatment worked and didn't work is lost in the process. Even for patients who, you know, are not terminal, it will help to save them from a lot of treatments that they really don't need. Let me just give you one specific example. The problems that I work with my collaborator, Dr. Connie Lehman and Dr. Manisha Bal, they noticed that some women who, you know, go through mammograms, they have some, it's called high-risk lesions. The cells are not normal, but they're still not cancer. You know, when they did biopsy, maybe they misdiagnosed and it is a cancer. or maybe the person is perfectly normal. So today the practice for all of these women to go and do a surgery and extract this lesion, which is obviously painful and expensive. And guess what? Only 17% of these women really had cancer. So you are putting through this whole process 87% of women with no good reason. So we actually develop a machine learning method which can predict for 30% at least of the women who currently go through surgery that they have no cancer and they don't need to go through unnecessary surgery.
Now, the thing that's made this very controversial over here is the question about consent for the use of data. What would the process be?
So in the United States, there are very strict rules about using patients' data. And I think the main criteria, whether the findings of the study are going to benefit the patients.
Are, say, pharmacology companies allowed to access it?
No.
Okay. No. Now, one of the problems we've heard about earlier in the program is what they call explainability. In other words, you don't actually know why the AI has made the decisions that it has. In a diagnostic situation, in a medical situation, that's pretty serious. So what have you been doing about that?
If you are to tell somebody you don't need to have a surgery or you do have to have chemo, you absolutely have to give reasons. Even the highly effective learning algorithms don't achieve 100%. So we worked on developing interpretable neural models. And what these models do, in addition to giving you a prediction, they also show to you what part of the input it looked at to make this specific prediction. The doctor can look at it and see if it makes sense to them or not. Sometimes it actually brings up some new features that, you know, human doctors didn't think about.
If we can solve problems like this, Regina, what do you think the consequences would be for healthcare, let's say 25, 50 years from now?
I think many diseases that we cannot treat today will be treatable, or we can identify them very early. And another important thing is the cost involved. As we know, for instance, in the case of cancer, if it is determined very early, even in precancerous state, it's easy to treat. The likelihood of success is extremely high. So machines can really help you to do this early detection and also to personalize treatment when you cut out all the necessary things.
Regina Barzilai. So, AI has the potential to solve some of the world's biggest problems, but any major change like this requires a lot of careful consideration of the social and economic impact, about the ethics. We need to start thinking about how we want AI to be used, how to regulate it, and do it now, before the technology advances and its applications are no longer within our control. That's all from the briefing room this week. My thanks to David Baker, Cathy O'Neill, Pippa Malgren, and Regina Barzilai. We'll be back next Thursday at 8 p.m. Good night. The briefing room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by China Collins, Jim Frank, and Serena Tarling. Please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.